Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we are going to be speaking briefly to Bill Hutchison, who's going to be talking about animals in some shape or form. We're also going to be speaking to our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White, about Pakistan. Right now, I would like to welcome Jim Hare, who's the Executive Director of Cornerstones Community Partnerships, and Elvi Vihil Olgard, who is a board member of Cornerstones. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Cornerstones is going to be holding a coming-of-age party at La Capilla de la Sagrada Familia in Pajarito at the foot of Black Mesa on Saturday, October 6th. Now, Cornerstones was formed 21 years ago. I love that you're having a 21-year coming-of-age party.
Well, we thought that was important because most people would celebrate 20 years as an anniversary, but we do so much work with educating youth in our projects that we wanted to celebrate coming of age, turning 21, which was an important year for them.
What is Cornerstones and how did it start?
We're basically a private nonprofit organization that was started 21 years ago as an umbrella project of the New Mexico Community Foundation to rescue the adobe chapels in villages in northern New Mexico that were close to falling apart. So we began as an organization called Churches, Symbols of Community, and then shortly thereafter spun off as our own nonprofit, and we were renamed Cornerstones.
Is it always churches and chapels?
No, in fact, I was just laughing yesterday. We've been working on historic buildings for 21 years, and just yesterday we got our first saloon to work on. So we've gone all the way from churches, chapels, to saloons.
Well, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah. The whole point is that we focus on community involvement, and we focus on historic structures that are community-owned. So, unfortunately, we can't really help out private property owners that have historic buildings, though we do give a lot of pro bono advice out. And we have a publication called Adobe Conservation, which is a handbook on adobe conservation principles that people find very useful. But we'll work on any structure. It doesn't even have to be adobe.
So how did it come together? Were there a bunch of adobe craftspeople and historic preservation people, or what happened?
You know, we've got a really interesting story here because one of our founding board members is the daughter of John Gamim, Nancy Worth. And she grew up seeing her father work extensively with people from around the country, actually. A lot of people from Denver, Chicago, who'd been in Santa Fe, fell in love with the architecture here and the environment. And they saw the great Spanish colonial monuments, like the San Jose Church at Trompas, the famous San Esteban de Rey at Acama, in bad need of repair. And so they started a society to do preservation work in the 1920s. And that went on for some time. Cornerstones is, in many ways, an outgrowth of that same approach to work with these rural communities that have these fabulous architectural resources, this architectural heritage, and rally people from not only New Mexico but from around the country to help out and restore them.
Now, when you say people from around the country, what kind of expertise are you bringing in from elsewhere?
Well, we have a wonderful local staff, and we're distributed around New Mexico from north to south. But we also work really closely with our peers in the cultural resource management organizations in Mexico. And we've learned quite a bit from them, particularly in the Frontera area, in Chihuahua and Sonora, where there are very remote villages that have 17th century, 18th century chapels, adobe buildings, and they've never been maintained in any way other than in the traditional methods. So we've actually gotten a lot of dialogue going between the two countries and the populations there, and we've learned that way. We've got other people from around the country. Just this summer, a group of students from SMU, Southern Methodist University in Dallas, that came up and worked for 4 days with us at San Jose in Trompas to provide just the labor that community needed to maintain what is probably considered the most architecturally significant and authentic Spanish colonial church in the country. We get funding occasionally from the Getty Institute out in California. We're very active with U.S. ECOMOS, which is the organization that exists under the umbrella of UNESCO internationally to protect cultural heritage worldwide. And we regularly host with the National Park Service and our compatriots down in Mexico a series of earth and architecture workshops that are open to anybody that wants to come free of charge right now. We've got one coming up outside of the city of Chihuahua in Chihuahua State on October 24th, 25th, and 26th, where we'll be working on a historic hacienda and visiting some adobe chapels in the area.
We're talking to Jim Hare of Cornerstones Community Partnerships. Elvira Vigil Olgaard, how did you get involved with all of this?
I got involved when Cornerstones came to us and asked us if we wanted to restore the church at Pajarito.
And, which is where you're from.
Yes. And so when they asked us, we jumped at the chance because all my relatives who were born and brought up there had disappeared, and we kept thinking, we've got to get this church back up. It was really going back to the earth. And so when they came, they helped us organize the fundraising, organize the expertise, organize everything. And the church was back erect in 2 years.
And is now used
only upon special requests, because it's really kind of isolated. There's not a community there. But because of Cornerstones, they brought a community together that wasn't there.
Well, that's interesting. That's what I was wondering, is when you have a community that has a church or chapel or whatever it is falling down, does Cornerstones come in and say, let's fix that? Or does the community go to Cornerstones and say, help us fix that? Or how does it work?
Well, it usually is that the community goes to Cornerstones. But there was a woman who lives close to Black Mesa who was very interested in the little church. And she asked her staff to look for whomever was available to contact. And they contacted me. And so from there, it just went on. And we started the project. Every Saturday, we would let the community that wasn't there would come in from every place, like Española, Santa Fe, Los Alamos, Albuquerque, and even out of state. They would come in and help every Saturday morning. And we'd work with, making adobes, making just everything.
And people would volunteer, so it was the labor was essentially voluntary.
Absolutely, yeah.
Very interesting, because, I mean, adobe used to be the free building material. It just took your sweat and time and labor. Mm-hmm. Now it's the most expensive building material.
Yeah, isn't that a shame, because it used to be something that everybody knew how to do. And, we have to be very careful to make sure that people understand that Cornerstones didn't reinvent this technology. In fact, by working with these smaller communities, we were able to gain knowledge from older members of the community that still knew how to do it. They taught us as much as we try to teach others. So that was a very important transfer of knowledge. But, wouldn't it be wonderful if every high school student in New Mexico graduated knowing how to make adobes? That's a project that we'd like to get going here. And if we could do that, I think we could shift the balance of the economics behind the cost of adobe bricks. Just imagine if every school in the state were stockpiling adobe bricks that their students made, and those could be used for either preservation projects or for new construction, and the school students could sell those and make money for their school. And that way, maybe we could revitalize this wonderful architectural heritage that we've got in the state, and which is so important for these issues of sustainability. Preserving a historic building is the greenest building practice you can practice. So it's an important modern development. It's not just about old buildings. It's really about our future.
So when you renovate a building, an old building, do you have to then bring it to all the modern building codes, even though you're working with adobes and natural materials and so on?
There are special building codes for historic structures, but you do have to make sure you're in compliance with those, and you also have to make sure you're in compliance with the state historic preservation standards, state and federal laws regarding historic structures, whenever federal or state funds are being used to renovate those buildings.
Tell us more about La Capilla de la Sagrada Familia.
Well, it was built in the teens, in the last century. I don't know, 1918 or 1920, somewhere around there, by my grandparents.
Is that right?
Yeah. And the reason why is because it was so isolated at that time that the only access they had to church was in Santa Cruz, across the river. And so because my grandmother wanted a place to pray, my grandfather and his children and the neighbors in Pajarito got together and built the church. And it was in use until they left, which was in the 1930s. And at that point, in the 1930s, it was divided between San Ilifonso and Santa Clara. And so the church now is kind of like in between the two pueblos. And so speaking of community, we have not only the community of my family, but the community of San Ilifonso and Santa Clara participating in the whole whole focus of the little church.
And so do the people from San Ildefonso and Santa Clara use the church? Did they help renovate it?
Well, they don't. Yeah, well, some of them help. But I'll tell you, Santa Clara, when they saw the church coming back to life, they came to us and said, you know, we have stories of our elders that they used to bring their santos across the fields from Santa Clara to Pajarito to bless their plantings, and they would have a pilgrimage. And when they saw the church coming back to life, they said, can we start this again? And we said, absolutely. So now every Memorial Day, after their planting, I don't think they do much planting anymore, but the tradition is carried on. They bring their santos across the fields, and we welcome them, and they pray a little bit. We have lunch for them, and then they go back. And so consequently, this thing has started all over again, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful cultural thing that almost died, but it's coming back.
Now, what are the provisions for maintaining a building like La Capilla or any of the other buildings once the renovation is done?
Oh, it's maintenance. Like
is Cornerstone's involved in that, or does it go back to the community?
Both. And we can maintain that little church. If we so choose, we can go to Cornerstone's and ask for help. So it's both.
We're talking to Jim Hare and Elvie Vigil Olgaard about Cornerstone's Community Partnerships, which is having a coming-of-age party on Saturday, the 6th of October. So where do you work? Is it all New Mexico?
We focus on New Mexico, but anymore we're a regional force in preservation, particularly with earthen architecture. Last year we had a project in the Cahuilla Mountains, in San Jacinto Mountains for the Cahuilla tribe above Palm Springs, California.
Oh, wow.
And we're active in the Big Bend area of Texas. We've worked in the San Luis Valley of southern Colorado. It really just depends. We'll go where we're needed. Most of our work is in New Mexico, though.
And how do you get your funding?
We beg.
Ah, yes. Sounds like public radio.
We're very fortunate. We have a very loyal base of individual donors. We get a lot of funding from private foundations. Unfortunately, we've gotten very little support from the state. Some monies from the National Park Service come in fairly regularly. But it's really through private private friends of Cornerstone's.
Now, you were talking a few minutes ago about how there are old-timers who know the old techniques. Do some of their old tools survive as well?
I haven't seen any. Of course, some of the old tools had been just the hand of enjarando, just mudding. And so that was really some of their old hands, their old tools. But the making of the adobes were just, you know, wooden forms and the mud that came from the earth. So that's really basically the tools.
Yeah, it's a good question to ask because when you think about it, there are very few tools that are really needed to do traditional adobe work. You need hose occasionally to mix up the mud and the water, but it's mostly handwork.
Yeah.
I was looking at this book last night, Adobe Conservation Preservation Handbook, and it had a list of some of the tools, and I was thinking, oh, look, let's look at what some of the old New Mexico traditional tools are, and they're things like oil plunger, paint roller, and it's all these things that you can find in a hardware store. So...
Well, and the handbook is good because it doesn't just cover making adobe bricks or working with earth plasters, but it talks about restoring earthen floors, working on wooden roofs, things like that. So a lot of the tools we talk about in the handbook are used for other purposes. And we do introduce new technologies and state-of-the-art preservation methods to help preserve certain aspects of buildings.
Yeah, I wanted to say one thing is one of the things that was brought up in this process of restoring the capilla was that some of the little old ladies that would come at every Saturday would bring some of the old ethnic foods from the area that had died really, but they would go out and pick weeds and stuff like that, and they'd have them for us for lunch, and it was fantastic. Some of the old people that would come in, they couldn't believe that this food was still alive. So it not only brought people together and old things together, but also food.
Very interesting.
Yeah, food, herbs, all sorts of things like that were brought back. In my thinking, they were definitely brought back to my mind from my childhood.
I was going to say, do you remember them from...
Yes, I do, from my childhood.
And I'm glad you're mentioning food because there's a really interesting new organization that I want to help plug for just a second because it also relates to one of the founders of Cornerstones, who is Susan Herder. And she's been very active in the establishment of the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute. The buildings we work on in these rural communities were there because there was a local economy based on agriculture. And while we focus on restoring these symbols of community, the buildings, and the Farmers Market Institute is trying to reestablish the local agricultural economy. And that's really an important act of preservation itself. So I'm really happy to see that coming along, and I'm really happy to see people who are instrumental in the founding of Cornerstones getting that off the ground. And consequently, that's just another quick plug, the Farmers Market Institute is having its fall festival on October 6th, the same day we're having our festival during the day at Pajarito. So you can easily do both. Theirs begins at 6 p.m. at Bishop's Lodge. So I hope people will come on out to Pajarito, have a nice picnic, see their friends and us, and then maybe go on and support the Farmers Market Institute.
So the coming-of-age party for Cornerstones Community Partnerships is at La Capilla de la Sagrada Familia in Pajarito, right at the foot of Black Mesa. It's Saturday, October 6th. At what time of day?
From 11 to 4.
11 to 4. And tickets are actually available at the Lenzing box office, 988-1234. There's more information available at cstones.com.
.org.
I mean, .org. Thank you. And Jim Hare is executive director, and Vigil Olgaard is board member of Cornerstones Community Partnerships. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we're going to be talking to the Bills. First, Bill Hutcherson, and then Bill Burke White. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Bill Hutcherson. He is the baddest dude in animal welfare from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm doing very well.
You're not advocating for the second best pet.
No.
Species.
No, I'm not advocating for the second best pet species. I'm advocating for what is today the first best pet species. The Santa
Dogs.
Fe... No, Mary Charlotte, God save you for saying such things. The shelter is gearing up for a huge week next week. We perceived an issue this year, which was that cats did not slow down. We got cats in like crazy, even through the winter months. And as you know, our winter months this last year were were pretty grueling. So Santa Fe is going to have a huge problem with cats in the coming months because there wasn't really a slowdown on the breeding. To that end, we at the shelter are about to kick off next week what we're calling our Crazy About Cats Week. As the marginalized species of the top two in domestic animal pets, we thought we needed to address the issue. We're going to, next week, endeavor to spay and neuter 500 cats and adopt out 100 cats. It's a pretty huge goal, but I think we can pull it off. We will need your help, Santa Fe. We're going to drop all of our cat adoption fees starting Sunday through Saturday to $20, and we'll do all cat spays and neuters for free. What's that you say? For free? Yes, I said, for free. We're going to have a cat issue if we don't get this taken care of, and we can't get this taken care of unless everyone in the community steps up and gives us a hand here. If you know anybody at all who needs to have their cat spayed or neutered, have them make an appointment at the shelter next week. If you've been thinking about bringing a cat into your life, next week is both the affordable and the socially responsible time to do so.
So why has there been such a big cat problem in Santa Fe?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't really know the answer. I would have thought that with the winter we had, it would have slowed breeding down, which it usually does. But we have so many feral colonies in Santa Fe, as well as a number of our fine citizens who have not yet gotten their cats spayed or neutered, which means that they may not be dealing with the kittens, but when their little dude runs around town, somebody else may soon be dealing with a load of kittens as a result. So if we want to stay on top of this, which to be frank, we're not. We're really drowning a little bit in cats right now in Santa Fe, then we all need to get together and do it. And I can hear a lot of heads nodding out there in radio land saying, yes, he's absolutely right. We do need to do something about it. I hope someone does something about it. Well, that's you. You're the one I'm talking to. If you're going to get a cat, next week is the time. If you know anybody who needs to get them spayed or neutered, next week is the time. We really, really have to get a handle on this.
Why would anyone get a cat when they could get a dog?
You know, it's a fine question, and it's one I find myself asking myself all the time. And I say that because I'm trying to buy a little time to think of a clever answer.
No, cats are wonderful pets, and
I have a cat to keep my dogs in line.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Does she or he do the trick?
She is the alpha cat. Absolutely, he is the alpha dog and the alpha cat. He has to unlock the door even for us humans when we get home. He's very picky about who he lets in the house.
Actually, I have an answer for that, and it's because I've lent somebody my mouse trap, and I can't remember who I gave it to, and I have a mouse, and I have no mouse trap. And cats,
you just gave me a great idea for cats.
Cats are great mousers.
They are. We can have a new slogan for cats. Cats, more than just a mouse trap.
Bill Hutchison, now, if people want to get their cat spayed and neutered for free, if they want to get a very low-priced cat for adoption, where do they call?
You can call the shelter at 983-4309. Crazy About Cats Week starts on Sunday, runs through Saturday. We'll be open till 6 p.m. on each of those days, so that if you want to swing by after work, you're more than welcome to see what kitties we have in there. And a little bit later today, up on our website at www.sfhumanesociety.org, you'll find all the details of Crazy About Cats Week. And as always, you can see all of our adoptable animals online at sfhumanesociety.org.
Bill Hutchison, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It is always a pleasure.
We're going to take yet another little break right now. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Pakistan with Bill Burke White. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome by telephone Bill Burke White. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our regular foreign correspondent on with us about once a month. Welcome, Bill.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you again.
It's great to have you. We're talking today about Pakistan, and part of the reason for this conversation is not only that Pakistan is in the news, but I find that I and probably some of our listeners, if not many of our listeners, know embarrassingly little about parts of the world very far away from us. I had to look at the map to see what the countries were that border Pakistan. And so we thought we would do a little bit of kind of a primer on this country. First of all, where is Pakistan? It seems to be on the northwest border of India, but it also borders Afghanistan, China. Are you there with us?
Yes, I'm there. Yeah, Pakistan is essentially, you know, in Southeast Asia. It has a sea border on the Arabian Sea and a long border with India, which has been the source of a long tension between India and Pakistan, particularly in Kashmir that you hear about. But it also has a border with China in the far north, because China actually extends quite far to the west and touches Pakistan. It also has a very long border with Afghanistan, which is part of why we're talking about Pakistan today, because of the situation in Afghanistan and the problems along that border. And then finally, it has a border with Iran. So in a sense, Pakistan touches on most of the countries that are really important to the future stability of everywhere from Asia to the Middle East.
So why does Pakistan matter so much to the United States?
Well, I think there's three separate reasons why Pakistan matters to us. The first is that in a sort of geopolitical sense of its location and its borders, right? So right now there is an ongoing war that we're part of in Afghanistan, and Pakistan has a great deal of influence in Afghanistan and has the long border there, and any sort of future security in Afghanistan Pakistan is important too. Likewise, Pakistan and India have a long border, and India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons now that are pointed at one another. So again, that geostrategic position is extremely important. The second reason that Pakistan is important to the United States is that in dealing with international terrorism, Pakistan is crucial. What are known as the tribal areas in the north of Pakistan that run along the border with Afghanistan are perhaps the greatest safe area for al-Qaeda, the place where Osama bin Laden is assumed to be hiding. And in terms of dealing with those terrorist threats, Pakistan matters a great deal. And finally, Pakistan is a Muslim state, perhaps one of the most important and influential Muslim states in Southeast Asia. And if our goal is to try to improve our relations with the Islamic world, we have to start in Islamabad, in a sense. And so what happens there in terms of whether there's a government that likes the United States or is fanatically opposed to the United States will be very important for our relationships with the rest of the Islamic world.
Let's talk about the history and government of Pakistan. How old a country is it in its current form of government? And what happened before? I mean, obviously it was part of the whole British rule in that part of the world.
Absolutely. So, of course, the British Empire controlled all of India and Pakistan. And it was not until 1947 that Pakistan was essentially born as a new state. When the British left their Indian colonies, there was a partition of India, and that partition, which was actually negotiated, in Delhi with the British authorities, led to there being one state of India and one state of Pakistan. Pakistan was the predominantly Muslim state, and India was the predominantly Hindu state, and there was actually quite a nasty period of war and conflict where populations moved and so forth. And then going forward, Pakistan has been at war with India a number of times, but has constantly been in conflict there. The next piece of that history is that in 1971, eastern Pakistan essentially attempted to secede from the country, and the new state of Bangladesh was formed. And so Pakistan essentially divided into two states, one of current Pakistan and one of Bangladesh, although the two don't actually touch one another because of the way the geography works. After that, Pakistan has had a number of sort of military coups where the military has essentially served as the final arbitrator of any political dispute. And when the military doesn't like the direction domestic politics are taking, they seize power. And the most recent time that has happened was in 1999 when General Pervez Musharraf, who is the current president of Pakistan, seized power in a military coup. That was certainly not the first time. Essentially, what happens in each of these cycles is that a prime minister or president is in power who, for some reason, the military decides to dislike, and they eventually overthrow them in a coup and have a military seizure of power that over time leads it back towards civilian rule and then a period of civilian rule before the military steps in again.
Tell us more about Pervez Musharraf. I mean, I saw him on The Daily Show. Seems like an amiable guy. What's his story? He's the president of the country. He's head of the military.
Yeah, he is both the president of the country, but also a general who controls the military. He's an extraordinarily shrewd political operator. A year or so ago, he came through the United States on a sort of world tour after publishing a new book. He is extraordinarily convincing. His history is as an army officer, a good one generally, one relatively well-liked in the military. And he came to power essentially arguing that Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, was so corrupt that he had to be thrown out of power. And Musharraf has essentially built his political support on two separate footings. The first has been an anti-corruption message, and then the second has really, you know, been about avoiding a religious state. His enemies or opponents are largely often religiously backed parties, and he has been a strong supporter of a secular state, even if it is one that is backed by the military. The other thing to know about Musharraf is that he is and has positioned himself as a good friend of the United States. Essentially, after the 2001 terrorist attacks, the Bush administration went to Pakistan and said, "You're either with us or against us," and you'll remember that rhetoric. And Pakistan was one of the few states that really you know, had a choice in which way to go and decided to be clearly with the United States, and has been a supporter of President Bush and addressing international terrorism. At the same time, you know, one of the great safe havens for international terror is and for religious extremism is these tribal areas of Pakistan. So Musharraf has tried to be a friend of the United States, but in so doing has perhaps undermined his own position in Pakistan, as he's been seen by both the religious parties and many of the tribal groups as just too close to the United States.
What is the nature of the anti-American sentiment among the religious groups and the tribal people in Pakistan?
Well, there's a couple of sources of that anti-Americanism, and the first, I think, is, in fact, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. These are not people who would be predisposed to like Western ways of life and Western, you know, consciousness to begin with, but right now we have U.S. troops on their borders in Afghanistan. We have undermined the Taliban regime that they were friendly with, and we have toppled the Saddam regime that they weren't friendly with, but that they do see as sort of an imposition of Western and American values. So the war in Afghanistan and Iraq has been hugely detrimental there. The second piece of that dislike of the United States is really about what about Western norms and values. These are very conservative, Islamic, religiously based communities that don't like what the United States represents and our way of life. I do think that that is part of it there. And I think the third aspect of the dislike of the United States is really a response to Pakistani domestic politics. These are people who don't like Musharraf being in power, who want much greater autonomy and a non-secular state. They essentially want a religious state, at least in their tribal areas. And as the federal government in Pakistan has sought to enforce secular rule rather than religious rule, and is seen as doing so as a puppet of the United States, that gives those people even greater disincentive to like the United States.
Let's go for a moment to the values piece. What specifically about American values is repugnant to the people you're talking about?
Well, I think first of all is, you know, certain, you know, the religious choices of the United States. These are people who are deeply religious and deep believers in Islam, and many of those tenets, if you're a truly deep, deep believer, aren't recognized or welcomed in the United States. And so, in the sense of even everything from whether you know, we wear the hijab on the street or whether we have a deeply sort of capitalist society. Are not things these people are predisposed to like. It's also true that they have poor information about the United States, and that information is usually being channeled through the very kinds of groups that are likely to sort of emphasize those aspects of America that may be most repugnant. In other words, our lack of religious values and beliefs, which you know, which I think is part of what's going on there.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. He is our foreign correspondent, and we're talking today about Pakistan. So there is a potential alliance with Benazir Bhutto and President Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan. Who is Benazir Bhutto? She comes from a family tradition of Pakistani politics.
Let me start by saying I think that we have to recognize that Pakistan is at this moment in a real constitutional crisis of the highest order, and that's why I think it's a good thing that we're talking about Pakistan today. That crisis has a couple of origin points, and Bhutto comes into that in a number of ways. But first of all, by October 15th, there has to be an election in Pakistan, and on November 15th, there will be either Musharraf will be serving a new term, or there'll be a new president in Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto is a former prime minister. She still has considerable power in Pakistan, areas of support, seats in parliament, and the parliament essentially elects the president in Pakistan, so those seats matter, and the prime minister. And she is interested in running for prime minister. She had been prime minister before and left, again, suspected of corruption, on a sort of self-imposed exile. She is now talking about returning to Pakistan to run for prime minister. Her father was prime minister. He was assassinated, and she became the youngest prime minister in Pakistan at the age of 35, and particularly the youngest female Muslim prime minister, I think, anywhere in the world. And so she now wants to return to power as this constitutional crisis gets sorted.
If I recall correctly, the corruption charges against Benazir Bhutto were to some extent, or there's credible evidence that they were to some extent trumped up and or even made up.
I think that's probably true. I have met her and talked to her on a couple of occasions, and she seems to be a very good, smart woman. Whether there were acts of corruption is hard to truly know, but what we do know is that the Pakistani military, when it wants to seize power, usually uses corruption as the reason for doing so, and it did that with Bhutto. It did that with Nawaz Sharif. My guess is that there were some corrupt people in her government, and that there was some grain of truth to the allegations. But that the allegations were, in a sense, used as an excuse to take power back. And so she is now trying to negotiate a deal whereby she would return to Pakistan to be prime minister. She would support Musharraf in his bid for a third term as president, and that that when she returns, her political party would support Musharraf's bid and thus get him reelected, and he would support her. 2 weeks ago, that seemed to be the most likely outcome, and that is certainly the outcome that the United States would prefer. It seems that that negotiation process has, at least to some degree, broken down, and a final deal has not yet been struck between Bhutto and Pervez Musharraf.
Let's talk about there is another player in all of this whose name you can pronounce better than I can.
Nawaz Sharif.
Thank you.
So he is another one of these former prime ministers, and he too controls a large block of the parliament. And I think I should say a word more about the nature of this constitutional crisis. So that General Musharraf is right now both the commander of the military and the president. And he was able to pass a constitutional amendment when he came to power that let him hold both of those titles. That constitutional amendment expires on October 15th. And in order for him to remain in power as president, he has to be elected by a majority of the parliament. In order for him to remain in power as both president and general commander of the army, he needs a two-thirds majority in parliament to pass a new constitutional amendment that would allow him to hold both seats. And at the moment, the only way that he could get that constitutional amendment is if either Benazir Bhutto supports him or Nawaz Sharif supports him. And the Supreme Court of Pakistan passed a resolution, a decision, allowing Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, overthrown by Musharraf, to return to Pakistan and run for prime minister. And Sharif did, in fact, return last week. He spent an hour on the ground at the airport, was accused of corruption charges and threatened with arrest, and was sent to Saudi Arabia as a way of not being arrested. So clearly Musharraf has said he's not going to ally himself in any way with Sharif and is trying to prevent Sharif from coming to power. So Musharraf now has a choice, really, of either forming an alliance with Benazir Bhutto to get the votes that he needs in parliament, or to run for president on his own and essentially give up his title of general and being commander of the army. And that would in turn in many ways undermine his own political support base that has allowed him to so effectively maintain power for the last 8 years. So he is in an extraordinary bind at the moment, and it's a kind of bind that he may not be able to get out of. If he gives up his title as general, he may not have the support he needs to win. If he allies himself with Benazir Bhutto, he may be seen as perhaps too close to the United States or too close to someone who was, you know, seen as corrupt. He's already broken any possible ties with Nawaz Sharif, and he's now in a very nasty fight with the Supreme Court. So we really are facing a situation in which Musharraf could lose power or there could be a very different political alignment in Pakistan.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. Under a scenario in which Musharraf gives up power as a general, as a leader of the army, and remains president with Benazir Bhutto as prime minister, what would his role be as president? What's the relationship between president and prime minister in Pakistan?
Right. So historically, Pakistan has had a president who was, I won't say a figurehead president, but a head of state, though most of the power really resided with the prime minister. When Musharraf seized power, he seized it from the military perspective, but did so assuming the post of president, and has essentially governed as the president of the country with a very weak prime minister or at times no prime minister at all. And so what both Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto want to see happen is a restoration of meaningful democracy in Pakistan, in which there is a prime minister who actually, you know, runs the government. And that's usually what happens in states that have a prime minister, whether it be, you know, England, you know, the United Kingdom or elsewhere. The prime minister really runs the government. And one of the things that Benazir Bhutto and Pervez Musharraf, the current president and the former prime minister, are fighting about at the moment is what would be that division of power between president and prime minister. Musharraf has said that the president must have the right to dissolve parliament, to sort of throw out parliament and have new elections and a new prime minister. And Benazir Bhutto does not want the president to be able to do that because it would essentially give Pervez Musharraf the power to throw her out of office whenever he wants to. And so right now part of this constitutional fight is about how much power the president would have and how much power parliament would have. The other part of the fight is about how much power the Supreme Court will have. Back in March, Musharraf threw out or sacked the president of the Supreme Court. The president of the Supreme Court was eventually reinstated by the court itself, But now there's a court that really doesn't like Musharraf. And part of the fight also now is about how many checks and balances the Supreme Court ought to have over the president. And in some ways, even though the cast of characters is different, the same kind of fights that we have had internally in the United States about how powerful the president should be versus Congress, or how powerful the president should be versus the Supreme Court. And these are fights that we've certainly revisited in the post-9/11 era. Pakistan is now being faced with and have to resolve really within the next month before these presidential elections take place.
What is the significance of the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear state?
Well, I think it makes this much, much more important to the United States. There is nothing worse, and I think it would in fact be even worse than an Iranian nuclear bomb, would be a nuclear bomb in the hands of the current leaders of the tribal areas in northern Pakistan. These are people who really don't like the United States and are really mad at us. And so I think that we have to recognize that the way politics plays out in Pakistan over the next week or month determines to some degree how secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons are going to be. I don't think that the Pakistanis, no matter who got elected, would launch a – they don't have the missiles to launch a bomb at the United States, but whether those nuclear weapons stay secure or might leak out to al-Qaeda depends in part on who gets elected in the next election in Pakistan. So I think it matters much more to the United States. We have, in fact, stayed very quiet as a government on these matters. The goal of the United States is an alliance between Benazir Bhutto and Pervez Musharraf, with the purpose being to sort of return Pakistan to from military rule to democracy, but to do so while protecting the interests of the United States. But we cannot say that out loud because there are enough people in Pakistan who don't like the United States that if we are seen as supporting Musharraf and Bhutto, it would probably undermine any potential they have to win the election. So there's a lot at stake for us in the United States as this moves forward, not just with respect to terrorism, but also with respect to regional security and nuclear security, all of which have to be at the top of our agenda at the moment.
Bill Burke-White, thank you so much for being with us today here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's always my pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
We'll see you next month. Bill Burke-White is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is with us just about every month speaking about foreign affairs. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, which means it lands in your iTunes box every day. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features the monthly New Orleans Hour. And Giants of Jazz features arranger-composer Bill Holman. And John has made it very clear and wants me to let you guys know out in Radioland that neither show will even mention O.J. Simpson. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.